Prisoner's Justice Day by John Scheffler at the CBI Minimum Unit. Sunday, August 10th, 2014 will be Prisoner's Justice Day. For those unfamiliar with this commemorative day, I will attempt to familiarize you with its origins by acquainting you with some of the events, sacrifices, and efforts put forth by convicts during the period from the 50s to the mid-1970s towards improving the penitentiary system, a system that at best could only be defined as outrageous, abusive, draconian, and ineffective. Additionally, I will reflect upon how the current government has steadily been obliterating most of what was gained in the 60s and 70s, more recently through bad legislative changes, which they frame on conservative ideology, thereby systematically restoring the non-functional prison model of the 50s and 70s. Just 4 to 5 decades ago, and in some cases more recently in Canadian prisons, convicts were put in the hole for up to 6 months for minor infractions and up to several years for major infractions, or simply for the good order of the penitentiary. There were no open visits, let alone private family visits. There was no redress procedure in place. There was no early parole. There were no radios or TVs allowed in the cells. There were no rights to make representations. The food was less than adequate, and only bread and water were served in the hole. Per month, convicts were limited to mail one letter and make one phone call as a privilege only. At the infamous Kingston Penitentiary, convicts were not allowed to speak unless spoken to. Punishment given to prisoners ranged from no yard and or common room time to being beaten. Other than life-saving intervention, health care was rarely provided. And lastly, other 7th century type barbaric and non-reformative practices. Changes to the above appalling prison conditions did not come about by chance or occur overnight, or just because it was the right thing for Canadian society to do. Rather, the enactment of an improved prison management system was prompted by the sacrifice, blood, and even the deaths of struggling convicts and the efforts of a handful of community activists who made the public aware of what was then an intolerable prison setting. For example, on August 10, 1974, Eddie Nolan died at the Millhaven Hole, where he had been kept for over 3 years, as a result of his participation in the Kingston Penitentiary riot. The subsequent inquiry board, looking at Eddie's death, made several recommendations for improving prison conditions, which 1 year later were still not yet implemented. As a memorial to Eddie Nolan, on August 10, 1975, Millhaven prisoners refused food, didn't report to work, and asked the administration to have the Nolan Inquiry Board's recommendations finally fulfilled. On May 11, 1976, Robert Landers, a prisoners organizer and spokesman, died of a heart attack in the Millhaven Hole. Then, the Millhaven warden testified at the inquest to Landers' death. He explicitly stated that Robert was segregated because he was demanding that prisoners' rights be acknowledged and respected. The inquest also concluded that the cell alarms in the hole were not in working order. Later, in an unrelated incident, Robert's brother, Glenn Landers, was shot while climbing Millhaven's fence during an attempted escape. He bled to death by the fence, and no staff member went to aid him. Shortly after Robert Landers' demise, for the anniversary of Eddie Nolan's death, Millhaven convicts issued an appeal to all prisoners to join together in a peaceful one-day strike for sharing the remembrance of those who died in prisons. Thus, Prisoners' Justice Day was born. From thenceforth, incarcerated men and women across the country commenced to observe the day by not working or eating. Likewise, a number of inmates' families and friends, community members, and various organizations on August 10th have been holding candlelight vigils outside of Canadian penitentiaries. After 1976, PJD developed into an internationally recognized memorial event. Prisoners' Justice Day is not only to reflect on the men and women who, through internal fortitude, sacrifices, and their own demises, paved a better path for us by forcing improved prison conditions and thereby public safety, but also to identify and raise awareness on the shortcomings of the current system. For example, issues and questions that should be asked at this time are: how is it that addicts and mentally ill people, as well as elderly prisoners, many of whom have passed their release eligibility dates, are housed in general population prisons, which do nothing to rehabilitate them or effectively treat them? Should they be in prison at all? How is it that an organization with a mandate of optimizing public safety by rehabilitating prisoners allocates only about 2% of its budget to reformative inmate programming? How is it that race and color of a person is still an impetus for imprisonment? How is it that wrongful convictions are still so frequent? How is it that the system allows itself to be filled with so much indifference that it does not step in to prevent loss of lives or release the terminally ill, the very old, and the incapacitated? How is it that the government can outright mislead the public to think that federal prisoners are spoon-fed, overpaid hotel residents in correctional facilities, and that someone who is once a criminal is always a criminal? The reality is that prison conditions are nothing like the Tories would like you to believe. Unfortunately, Mr. Harper is using this tainted assessment and ideology as a smokescreen to introduce policies that do not actually cut costs, enhance public safety, or even reform inmates. For example, over the last year, this government enacted changes to claw back from inmates' gross pay another 22% for food and accommodation. 32 years ago, in setting inmate pay levels, living expense deductions were already effective. Now that the CSC collects money from the inmates for food, it has decided to cut back on an already meager diet. House two inmates at once in a cell, which was built for one. A surcharge of 8% calculated on inmates' gross pay for the administration of the inmate telephone system. It would be fair to say that the CSC performs very little administrative service for this levy, which is in addition to a user fee of 11 cents to $1.70 per minute, or $2 to 57 cents for local and long-distance calls, and applies to even those who do not access the system. It is likely that the CSC uses the funds generated by the 8% surcharge to pay Bell for a recently installed security device designed to detect and discontinue conference calls. However, the device does not work. As a consequence, inmates' calls are constantly being terminated for a variety of invalid reasons, from assorted background noises to electronic equipment in the vicinity of the telephone. Although the CSC acknowledges these reasons for the terminated calls, all inmate requests for shutting off the device or to get refunds are denied by the Correctional Service of Canada. Institutional disciplinary fines are quadrupling from $25 to $50 up to $100 to $200. For a minor infraction of one inmate loaning or giving a couple of aspirins or a can of tuna, items he purchased on canteen, to another inmate, both could be fined up to $100. The maximum fine for smoking is $200 plus segregation time with zero pay. This new fine structure is so high that it is no longer viewed as a deterrent. Not to mention that the fine versus inmate's pay does not fit the crime and is disproportionate with community standards. A misdemeanor fine, 4 months of a citizen's pay, it never happens. These new pay clawbacks plus other compulsory deductions leave inmates with disposable earnings from 8 cents to $3.11 per day. The elderly and disabled who cannot find jobs receive only 83 cents. Out of these scanty amounts, inmates must manage to make court-ordered payments and voluntary payments to victims, family, parental support, legal fees, tuition costs, charitable donations, etc., plus pay for the costs associated with periodic temporary absences, which are often directed and mandated by the parole board. To maintain community contact, like subsidizing visits and pay for stamps, stationery, and telephone calls. To subsidize the 28 cents per day CSC allowance for basic and desired health and hygiene items, including over-the-counter medications and therapies not provided by healthcare, and personal grooming products, headache and cold remedies, shampoo, hand and laundry soap, shaving cream, mouthwash, dental floss, and other items are included. We need to purchase basic and desired food items like coffee, tea, whitener, canned beans, soup, vegetables, fish, rice, oatmeal, and cereal. We need to purchase for leisure and recreation time things like sweatshirts and track pants, t-shirts and running shoes, socks, our televisions, radios, headphones, etc. On all goods, inmates pay appropriate taxes, delivering and handling charges, and cannot take advantage of items offered on sale or on any tax credits. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, to save funds for release, the main reason in the first place for awarding remuneration. It bears noting that 85% of inmates are eventually discharged, and if the inmate has no savings to his credit at the time of his release, he or she is provided transportation to his or her destination and a mere $50. How is it that vis-a-vis the above demands on inmates' disposable income, the government not only increased compulsory pay deductions, but at the same time canceled production incentive, remuneration, and have been terminating successful programs like the Frontenac Prison Farm? How is it that the commissioner of the CSC, with his large army of Ottawa-based managers, are non-timely and non-responsive to our needs, initiatives, and suggestions? The implementation of which would not only promote public safety, but also prove to be beneficial to the public purse. Setting more and more financial demands on inmates' income, which has not been raised for the past 32 years, are not only keeping offenders incarcerated for longer periods. On an average, this cost is $220,000 for a female and $115,000 per male inmate. On the other hand, it would take less than $30,000 in the community to furnish an inmate's reformation on a conditional release and community supervision. The greatest majority of inmates are not looking for sympathy. They just want to be treated fairly, especially on issues affecting prison conditions, their rehabilitation and releases, their families and the public. It is difficult to categorize these recently implemented measures as being fair to prisoners or even to society at large. Unquestionably, the CSC once was resonated globally as an exemplary correctional institution, but now is quickly losing that status because of the current government's imperceptive, callous, and degrading methods of operation, which is clearly based on conservative election platform ideology and not on social or economical responsibility. This government's misdirected, tough-on-crime agenda eradicates corrections and replaces it with appalling penitentiary standards from 4 or 5 decades ago. Prisons are becoming more of a warehouse than institutions that protect society by actively encouraging and assisting inmates to become law-abiding citizens while exercising reasonable, safe, secure, and humane control of those in their care. That's a quote, actually, from the Mission, Vision, and Values of the Correctional Service Canada. Today's prisoners are in a different situation than those of the 70s. It has become more difficult to influence the government in the CSC. Nonetheless, individually and collectively, we must raise our issues and get the politicians and the media to vigilantly monitor prison conditions and draw the public's attention to the facts. Mr. Harper is implementing the redundant U.S.-style law and order retrogressive agenda for the purposes of cashing in on votes. And if that is what society wants, are they and we prepared to pay the price?